pleasure to be in with you tonight. We're talking with Nick Redfern about the real Men in Black, and a couple of emails are coming in. And one of them is regarding what appears to be real Men in Black, three of them. And now somebody's going to send an email that says, "Ingenuous, you're just trying to exploit this for theatrical purposes." No. Remember a while ago, you might have heard me say, "I hate cell phones." Well, I don't hate them because, believe it or not, the landline, the hard line, has dropped 4 times, and then the cell started dropping. 24 hours in a day, 24 beers in a case, and 4 drops on a hard line, and then the cell starts dropping. Coincidence? We'll return with Nick Redfern in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Nick Redfern, I had a, that's really strange about the phone, don't you think? Are we being messed with by the MIB?
Well, you know, it sounds bizarre. This is like the 5th or 6th time I've done interviews about the Men in Black mystery where I've had hassles on the phone. And, you know, it sounds bizarre, but it's, that is something that people within the MIB field, particularly witnesses, report time and time again. And rather oddly, John Keel, who we were just talking about it, was someone who experienced a great deal of that with sort of hang-up calls, electronic interference on the phones. And, you know, for us, for people who are listening, probably don't know the background, but for the landline to drop 4 times and then the cell phone to drop, and now we've had to sort of have you call back on another landline on the very night we're talking about the Men in Black, that's sort of like really weird.
It certainly is. Now, let me just... let me read this to you and just give us an idea what this might be. Sure. It says, about 20 years ago when my father was in hospice care, he told me about his encounters with Men in Black. He described them just as people who have seen them, 3 guys dressed in black with hats. He said they had visited him a number of times in his hospice room. At one point, while he was in the room with him, his dad screamed, "Tell them to go away." He was terrified. I couldn't see anything. Then he described the Men in Black who were supposedly standing at the foot of his bed. There was no strange paranormal activity in the room. How might your guest explain this? Or can you?
Well, that's interesting because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that in many of the earlier reports, particularly, they turned up in groups of 3. And I think the witness, didn't the emailer just say that there were 3 of them?
Yes, in hats.
Yeah. And also with Albert Bender's experience, I mean, although there are a lot of differences, you know, they turned up in his bedroom when he was sort of in a, you know, a semi-dream state. So, you know, that in itself is unusual. And as I said, you know, people have talked about seeing the Men in Black in situations where there's been poltergeist activity and also situations, you know, around death and things like that. So, again, this, you know, the emailer's message is actually very typical of some of the things we get. You know, as I said earlier, a lot of people's idea of the Men in Black is driven by the Men in Black movies, you know, but the reality is far more in line with what the emailer has said. You know, this sort of stranger, I guess you could argue, paranormal aspect to it. But it's, you know, it's again, it's a case I'm not aware of previously. So, you know, this is another example of how, you know, many of the reports that have occurred or the incidents that have occurred simply haven't been reported unless people, you know, have an outlet and somebody to speak to, like, you know, we're doing tonight. But that sort of thing is far more typical than, you know, sort of FBI types in suits banging on the doors. You know, it is more along the lines of what the emailer just said.
Do they generally appear to just one person at a time? And if that's the case, is it possible that if there were someone else standing around, that that person might not see the same thing that the person who's being visited sees?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question, John, because for the most part, the witnesses are solitary. Now, you know, and it's almost as if the situation and the time has been chosen carefully. For example, you know, there are UFO authors and witnesses who, you know, have been married, but the Men in Black have turned up when there's nobody else at home, you know, and there's nobody else who experiences, you know, the encounter. And again, like other aspects of the mystery, if that were just to happen once or twice, we could put it down to just coincidence. But when the person appears to be targeted, when there's no one else around to, you know, vindicate the experience or to offer backup testimony, then you have to wonder, you know, quite rightly, what sort of situation or what sort of version of reality did the experience occur in? You know, was the person in some sort of semi-trance or altered state at the time of the encounter that allowed the experience to go ahead? I mean, that's one of the things that's been suggested, is that, you know, that the sheer strangeness of the experience, maybe, you know, it hasn't occurred in a normal sort of state of reality. That was certainly what happened with Albert Bender. You know, it was, as I said, he lived in this sort of creepy old house in the attic. And, you know, the man in black would appear when he would go into this sort of weird, dizzy, lightheaded, altered state. And the big question is quite, you know, you bring up a good point. If there had been other people there, would they have seen exactly what Bender saw? They may not have done. You know, some people have wondered whether the MIB experience is more a real experience, but if it's sort of visionary and internal to the person, that whatever the intelligence is behind this, that it's sort of projecting this MIB imagery rather than, you know, having a sort of a 3D figure turning up at the front door. You know, maybe that's why they're so elusive, because there is sort of this ethereal, you know, almost like Matrix style aspect to it, you know, where it's where you begin to wonder what is reality and what isn't.
Nick, just a little side trip here. You know how mankind is. That includes the girls, too, just in case anyone's wondering. And it's like, oh, boy, we split an atom. Oh, I know what we can do with this. You know, sometimes, well, I haven't ever seen it fail, just like this terahertz generating chip that science, in another obtuse application, has decided to put into mobile phones and strip the helix strand and cause problems, according to some authorities on the subject. And I'm just wondering, this is just a question, do you think the Men in Black might be doing us a favor by saying, you don't need to play with this at all? You really don't.
Well, you know, this has actually been brought up, the idea that, you know, maybe, ironically, they're not the bad guys. You know, we perceive them as the bad guys because they come across as sinister, menacing and threatening. But, you know, there are people, for example, one of the people I interviewed for my The Real Men in Black book was a guy named Ray Beauchet. Ray is a UFO researcher who lives he's in the United States, and he's a long-time researcher of the UFO phenomenon. And he basically came round to the idea that the phenomenon is sort of very negative and not one that, you know, of a positive nature that we should be embracing. And, you know, he sort of feels that it's a phenomenon we should stay away from. And Ray lives up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he's done a lot of very good thought-provoking writing on this particular topic and lectured on it. And he feels that the MIB angle, if you like, is a manifestation of evil, if you like, is probably the best way to describe it. And that, you know, the more we delve into this subject, the more negative it all becomes for the person. And, you know, other people have suggested, well, maybe a byproduct of that is that some of these MIB, if not, certainly not all of them, you know, are warning us to stay away from something for our own good. But we perceive it as they're trying to stop us from getting the truth. Or maybe, you know, maybe it's a combination of things, because as I, you know, I pointed out at the beginning, we have these weirder MIB that Albert Bender saw, but then there are other cases where we can trace them back to, almost certainly, to government agencies. So, you know, maybe when people say, well, who are the men in black, we should be asking which category. And I think that's why the subject is sort of so challenging and weird, is purely and simply because it has these different strands to it that point in different directions, and some of them could be good guys, some of them could be, you know, your worst nightmare.
This is interesting. This man writes, the title is Men in Black in India. It reminds me of a story that happened to me in India. I'd gone to study with a religious Sufi saint, and we would meditate late at night, And sometimes there'd be three or more pale-looking individuals always wearing black suits, but when we came out of meditations, they were gone. I also saw some really well-maintained old model cars around the sage's house and would figure that it were the people's car who came to him for help. So,
well, that's interesting because, you know, even today, and as far back as the 50s, the men in black always, or for the most part, drive old-fashioned cars. You know, today, the cars they drive, you know, they're still talking about these sort of 1950s sort of Cadillacs, you know, and with the shark fin tails and, you know, just totally black and often sort of the white-rimmed tires, that sort of thing, you know, as if they'd stepped out of some sort of 50s gangster movie. But what's interesting is that people have said that these cars look brand new. You know, the sort of thing you might see at, you know, one of these car displays, people who renovate old cars, you know, and look after them and make them look brand new. That's what people have said about these cars at the Men in Black drive, that they're old, but they look like they've just come straight out of the showroom.
Isn't that strange? I mean, this just sounds like the most wonderful kind of fantasy. You know, I mean, this is the stuff that enjoyable stories are made out of. Guys with good fashion sense, but they're a little pale and undernourished, driving really smoking hot cars and telling people in well-educated British dialect, we would prefer that you did not continue with your observations nor report any of this to the media. Bye.
Yeah.
By the way, have you checked your brakes?
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
It does sound like, you know, the sort of perfect scenario for a sci-fi movie. And of course, we've got three of them, all starring Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, pretty much G-rated, too.
Yeah, but in saying that, you know, it's, as I said, it's this darker, weirder aspect to it, you know, and that, you know, your latest email is very interesting because, you know, the story talked about the person getting into an altered state of mind and then seeing the MIB, which is exactly what happened with Albert Bender, which is exactly what has happened with many people in the subject, you know, that, for example, they've seen these things sort of manifest in their dreams. I mean, you mentioned Raven Mindell earlier. Raven, you know, her experiences with the MIB were sort of initiated when she woke up in the middle of the night, one particular night, and felt there was this oppressive force in the room. And that, although it didn't explicitly say anything, you know, in some sort of thunderous voice, she got the feeling that the phenomenon, whatever this threatening phenomenon in the room was, it wanted her to stay away from the UFO subject. So you could argue, you know, that waking up in the middle of the night from a deep sleep and, you know, feeling and detecting this presence in the room is also an altered state. You know, you are in a sort of semi-awake altered state in the middle of the night. So, you know, I think there is something to the idea that this phenomenon interacts with us and can manipulate sort of the human mindset to where maybe some of these experiences, the witness assumes they're occurring in like a 3D reality, but could they actually be some sort of provoked, you know, sort of semi-real matrix, literally like a matrix-type dream world, you know, where it's very real to the person and there's a genuine phenomenon behind it, but it's sort of stage-managed and stage-crafted by whatever this phenomenon is. And maybe, again, that would explain sort of the elusiveness, the elusive nature of the MIB in the sense that they seem here one minute, gone the next, there's no hard evidence. Well, you know, if the phenomenon is almost like a program, you know, that is running and the person experiences that program, and then when the program finishes running, it comes to an end and it's all over, maybe that might explain, you know, why these things are so elusive, because they're not real in they're real, but not in our physical 3D sense we understand the term.
You know, this is, I'm beginning to see a pattern here. Here's one for you, Nick. In 1976, this is from Rob. It says, in 1976, I had two encounters I will never forget. Both of my parents were in classified work, my mother in the testing and manufacturing of advanced weapon systems, including nukes. I did not know this until after she passed. And my dad had been a major in the Special Forces. I was 15, and that summer, two MIB came to the door. They told me they were from my mom's work and wanted to take a look around. They placed a nondescript box in my closet with many instructions. I told my parents, and it was like they already knew about it. 4 months passed, and one MIB came back for the box, and that was it. So it seems like nuclear things and advanced talking about or attempting to activate any advanced energy systems, you know, like when they show up at RAF Bentwaters, like when they show up at these various nuke bases, like when they actually, there are reports that have been corroborated by numerous individuals, not only the one who released the information, but otherwise, that they deactivated 10 or 14 nuclear warheads in the Great American North, and then 2 weeks later did it at another base.
No, you're right. I mean, UFO sightings and, you know, sort of nuclear bases and nuclear weaponry, etc., they go sort of hand in glove. And a lot of it is related to sort of a demonstration of power, I think, that, you know, hey, we can scramble your launch codes. We can prevent, you know, this technology from being accessed or used. But it's interesting you talk about, you know, the MIB, or the witness talks about the MIB being associated, again, with people working in the fields of advanced technology, because one of the things I talk about in my book is that if you go back in history, you can find stories where alchemists, you know, 400, 500, 600 years ago, people who were looking to understand the mysteries of sort of turning base metals into precious metals, you know, which is the definitive description of ancient alchemy, they would talk about how they were visited late at night, you know, in their, I guess in simple terms, their labs, where they were, you know, trying to turn sort of, you know, a base metal into something really profound like gold or whatever, that they would get these visitations from these threatening guys, not in black suits like the men in black today, but they would turn up on a black horse wearing a black cloak and warn them about the perils of dabbling in alchemy and why they should leave it alone. So,
really?
Yeah. So you can, you know, when people say, when did the mystery begin? Albert Bender kind of kicked it off in the modern era. But if you go back, I mean, I'll give you another classic example. You know, a lot of people would imagine that with the men in black, because they're sort of threatening, etc., that when they turn up on people's doorsteps, you know, they just kick the door down and force their way in. They don't. What they actually do is that they always sort of patiently wait on the doorstep, knock on the door, and they won't enter until you invite them in. Which is, of course, a classic parallel with the sort of the folklore that's been attributed to vampires, that, you know, the vampire can only enter your home when you invite it in. And,
right.
Of course, you know, in times past, the image of the vampire is this sort of pale-faced creature dressed in black, you know. So we could make the argument, if you like, that the motif of the Men in Black has been around for a long, long time, but it's changed subtly over the years from the dark cloak character on the horse warning people about alchemy, to the vampire who won't come in the house to unless he's invited, to
Excellent.
The MIB who warns about dabbling in UFOs and who still won't come in the house until he's invited. So, you know,
All right,
we can
Nick.
Actually make that argument, but it's a very old mystery.
All right, my friend. Stand by. We'll be back with more of Nick Redfern. This is good when Coast to Coast AM returns. And it's true, can't turn back the hands of time, so we're going to make the most of the time that we have. Happy, respectful, reverent, and sobering Memorial Weekend to everybody. John B. Wells, delighted to be in with you tonight with our guest for the bulk of the program, Nick Redfern. We're talking about the Men in Black, and boy, there's a lot of stuff coming in. We're going to take some of your calls, and according to this email box, who are qualifying it with, see if this passes the test, the Toro meter. It looks like a few people out there have actually seen these guys. So let's get back with Nick in just 2 minutes on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Nick, what do you think about taking a call?
Sure.
Let's hear from Dee Dee on the West Coast in her undisclosable location. Welcome to the Bridge of the Mothership.
Thank you, John, very much for taking my call this evening. And good evening to both your gentlemen.
Good evening
to Mr. Redfern there.
Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi. Are you the same Mr. Redfern, if I may ask, that wrote the Celestine Prophecy back in the 80s?
I'm sorry?
Are you the same Mr. Redfern that wrote the Celestine Prophecy book back in the 80s?
No, that's not me, no.
Oh, that's not you, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, John, I want to let you know that I'm a DJ by trade. I have been for about 27 years, and I used to run Art Belt way back in the day, 84, 85.
Oh, yeah. Well, but that was a blast.
Yeah, it was a blast. It was way back almost before CDs, you know. And so anyway, I've been with Coast for many years. But with all that said, the only reason I'm willing to even call in and relate my MIB story is that I, and I know this is not a religious discussion, but I am currently a Christian, and I did not used to be. Up until 2004, I was a full-blown Wiccan for about 25 years. And back in the 60s, I will start out and make this as brief as possible. I've had so many unusual experiences, and so has my family, with seeing UFOs and different things. In 64, in a little town I lived in, my parents and I saw some UFOs. The whole town saw them, basically, in short. Project Blue Book guys came out, and then that was written down and recorded in a book, and later on that was shut down and whatever. So it's always been something ongoing. In about 1996, my whole family moved out to this property. It was about 65 acres here in southern Colorado, and it's a very mountainous region with a valley and everything. And so we'd all had very strange experiences, and I'm never looking for them. I'm, you know, like I said, I'm a DJ by trade, and that's how I think. But for some reason, all of my life, things have followed me around, and sometimes you just can't avoid it. So in 98, when I first moved in where I live now, my older daughter and I were standing out on my deck. It was about 5:30 in the afternoon. And even though this isn't about UFOs per se, we saw this craft come right over the house. And there was a couple of occupants in it. It watched us. We watched them. And we weren't sure if we were awake. We were, like, poking each other in the arm, saying, "Are you seeing this? Are you awake?" We're freaked out. And we were seeing it, and then it flew off. Okay, well, that was weird. And that's just one of the things that's happened since we've lived out here. And then a couple of years after that, she lived in a mobile home on one side of our property. And I lived in a mobile home on the other side of our property, which was probably a distance of about almost a football field in length. And there's a road that would go up by, we live in a little valley off of a valley, and this little road is a dirt road, and it parallels us. So you can look right out there and see who's coming or going, you know, for whatever.
Gotcha.
And she called me one evening, and she said, "Mom," she goes, "there's two really weird lights coming down the road." And I said, "What do you mean, like car lights or what?" And she said, "No, I didn't think so." She said, "But let me call you right back." So I wait. She calls me back, and she goes, "Mom," she goes, "you got to look out the window. There's something really weird. These lights were coming down the road around this corner," and she could see it from her front door. I could not see it from where I lived because I was back next to the mountain on the other side of the field, kind of on the dark, scary part of it, you know. And these lights raised up off the ground, and we were on the phone by this time. And I was there by myself, and I didn't have a car at that time, and it was at night, so there was no way I was going to get out and walk to her house. And these lights raised up off the ground, but they were wider than car lights. Well, we all believed in UFOs. Right away, we knew something was weird. They turned right and went straight over my house. Okay, little be known to, I just stayed in the house.
Now, as a result of this, did you meet any men in black?
Yes, we did.
You'd have to telescope this a little bit because this. I want to get some more people on. I don't want to be rude, but move along. I want to hear about the men in black.
Okay, shortly. The UFO left all these marks on the tree, which are still there to this day. A couple of days after that, she called me at 5:30 in the afternoon, and she goes, "Mom, there's a weird truck out front on the road." I went outside halfway, and she met me halfway on this little road that went between us. We looked, and there was these guys in this white little, kind of like a little, truck, but it had, like, white panels on it, no windows on the back. They were wearing black suits. They were kind of small guys. They had black hats, sunglasses, very pasty, deathly white, like chalky, like chalk white. And we were like, "Oh, that's too weird," because we'd never seen them in MIBs, but we had heard about them. And they went up the road, and then they turned left where there was no road onto the other side of the street, and their car literally, all I can describe to you is that it floated or hovered above the ground where there was no road. It went up the mountainside a little bit. It made a really weird little U-turn thing, came back down, went back on the road, started coming back down in front of our house. By this time, I guess it had wheels or whatever it did, or at least that's what it looked like to us. And they stopped right in the middle of the road, and they just robotically, very slowly, looked left and looked at the both of us. We were frozen in fear standing there. And
I
then
can
they
imagine.
Looked straight ahead. and they drove off.
Now, what, DJ, thank you so much for your extraordinary account. Nick, what do you make of that?
Well, actually, you know, that's not as rare as people might think. There are a number of cases on record, and I actually include, ironically, several in the book where people have talked about seeing the men in black, their cars literally vanish or, you know, act under strange circumstances. There are several from the US, one from Mexico I can think of, and one from the UK, a famous one, where the car literally sort of, or just literally like winked out of existence. So, you know, this again is a classic aspect. And, you know, Dee's description of the guys looking sort of pale and pasty, you know, you and dressed in the black hats, you know, you just cannot get a better description of the MIB. You know, that's what they look like.
This is absolutely strange. I mean,
oh, it is. There's nothing about the Men in Black mystery that isn't strange. You know, whether it's the cars, the out-of-fashion clothing, the way they act, you know, the threats, everything about them is just, you know, just bizarre.
Well, it's interesting. There's stuff up on YouTube about it. You know, must see real life Men in Black enter hotel asking questions after UFO reporting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, go ahead. You just jump in anywhere you want.
Yeah, it's a situation where, you know, I think the big problem that we have is not the abundance of reports. There certainly is an abundance of reports. It's trying to make sense of it to where we can sort of second-guess the MIB and catch them in the act. You know, that would be the perfect scenario where we could develop some sort of pattern that we could then follow, you know, in the same way that the police do, you know, if they're looking for a serial killer. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen because sometimes, you know, the cases are profound. Other times they're just, you know, you even wonder why they even bothered turning up. You know, the witness just saw a vague light in the sky, but they got visited. And then sometimes it's the investigator, the, you know, the UFO researcher, and there just doesn't seem to be any sort of rhyme and reason. It's not always something we can pinpoint. So, you know, that's why I'm always sort of appreciative when people like Dee Dee report, you know, their encounters, because at least, in my view at least, the more reports that we have, the better chance we have of trying to put together some sort of pattern that might, you know, indicate what's going on and how we can, that's one day, get there before these guys turn up, so to speak.
Wow. We got a Skype call. Blake, are you there? If Blake is there, let us speak with Blake. I think he's there.
Yes, Don. How are you doing tonight?
Very well, sir. Thank you. How are you?
Great. I wanted to talk to you about the Men in Black and what's been happening recently.
Okay. Talk with you and Nick, get together on this and give us some edification on this most singular subject.
Hey, Blake.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to share with the audience of what has been happening to me lately is that the Men in Black have been showing up in videos as of recently, when we have been talking to a special person. His name is Robert Bingham. He claims he can summon UFOs at will telepathically. And we've been broadcasting actual video from the location in L.A., and Men in Black have been present.
Anybody catch them on video?
Yes, they have.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. They've been showing up in videos.
Exactly. On April 3rd, across from the Park Plaza Hotel, June 3rd, at the Park Plaza Hotel, he's going to be summoning UFOs again for the public. And over 200 eyewitnesses come out to the event when he summons UFOs. And there are Men in Black present.
And do any of the UFOs show up?
Absolutely.
What kind? Very quickly, what kind of UFOs? Little orbs, little saucers? What are we talking about? Big scary motherships? What?
Well, Bingham hasn't summoned the massive mothership, but he is absolutely summoned.
That's us.
Or metallic objects. Something that's never been seen before, and he's doing it in front of eyewitnesses live. And it's happening again on June 3rd, 2012, across from the Park Plaza Hotel. Again, I do get death threats. Once I've met John Bingham and have exposed him for the first time in the public that he's actually doing this, I've been contacted by Men in Black myself.
They showed up in person?
Yes, they have.
And they looked like, as have been described? Black suits, pasty face, all of that?
It's all been said here on the radio, so I'm not...
Gotcha. Concerned. All right, we're losing them. Thanks, Blake. Thanks very much. Okay, so it's undeniable that there's the... The UFO nuclear thing is all, mm-hmm. it's all rolled into one.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, John, you know, that just, you know, tonight talking about, you know, you asked me earlier about how many reports we have, and, you know, there's hundreds on file. Well, you know, we've already got sort of three or four new ones tonight, you know, where people just come forward, and they're sort of classic examples of what, you know, people are talking about, which again sort of leads me to believe that the number of reports that are on file really is, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, if we get four tonight, you know, how many more are out there?
Well, strange. Mm. A lady named Diana said, doesn't know if this is related or not, but about 20 years ago, her husband and she moved to Colorado to attend college there. And, having a trip and fall over a crack in the sidewalk, and when I got up, turned around, I bumped into two men walking their way. They were very pasty face, black hair, black clothes, wearing trench coats, but were leather. But when the point is, when she bumped into them, they felt blank to me, like soulless, and her husband said the same thing.
Oh, wow.
Who knows? Maybe they're just grunge rockers. I don't know. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Well, but, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's one of the things a lot of people have said is that, you know, the MIB, no matter the circumstances, they seem totally emotionless. You know, not so much in terms of being stern, you know, in terms of just trying to instill fear or, you know, hostility, but actually just don't act the way we do. You know, they don't seem to have that same sort of, you know, mindset that we do, that the emotion, it isn't something that they're withholding to look stern or official. They just have a very different way of thinking to what we do. And, you know, there are cases, for example, where, you know, the MIB have threatened the witness, and then occasionally the witnesses have stood up to them and said, you know, no, I am going to tell people. And then the MIB suddenly, they don't know how to act. You know, they just sort of stare enigmatically as if, you know, they've been sort of, the program's been in, you know, virus or something. You know, they don't know how to respond, and it's almost like their program has been crashed because they're just not fully conversant, you know, with our mannerisms and ways. And when we kind of put a glitch in the program, that sort of amps the weirdness up even more. So, you know, we're looking at entities or things, however you want to term them, that you know, emotionally, etc., are very, very different to us.
Now, a while ago when the line failed, I just read a little bit out of your book about Raven Mindel. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mindel, that's how it's spelled.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, Mindel.
And she's a radio talk show host that was doing the Wiccan thing for a while. So, now what happened to her? Because I didn't just continue to read, because you came back.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, as I kind of mentioned briefly earlier, Raven is a Wiccan and also done a lot of paranormal and cryptozoological and ufological investigations, and had this experience where she was doing a lot of UFO studies and then woke up, or was woken up, however you want to look at it, in the middle of one particular night with this sort of distinct feeling that there was something paranormal and threatening in the room. And although there was no sort of explicit, you know, imagery that she could see, she got the feeling there was definitely a presence, and it was basically very hostile and warning her to stay away from the UFO subject. And for a while she didn't, and she began to experience a lot of weird activity in the house. Very strange activity that her husband reported as well, sort of feeling like a wind going through the house when there were no windows open, no air conditioning on, and finding like little handprints on windows and things like that. Very strange stuff. And eventually she got to the point where she realized that, you know, this phenomenon was going to keep bothering her, if you like, as long as she delved into the UFO subject. And it kind of all culminated when she began seeing these two characters, not one or three, but two, sort of watching the house and driving past the house slowly in a car, clearly making it obvious that they wanted to be seen. You know, that seems with the whole motivation was to ensure that she saw them, and it had the desired effect. You know, Raven basically came to the conclusion that, hey, you know, there's some intimidation going on here, and unfortunately it's working. And she did back away from the UFO subject. You know, she still takes an interest in cryptozoology, but she really did walk away from the UFO subject. And that's often, you know, what happens is that the sort of desired effect of the MIB works. You know, people do walk away. And Raven's case is an interesting one for several reasons, not just for what happened, but because it only occurred 2 years ago in 2010. You know, so this is sort of 60 years almost after Albert Bender, and they're still following the same path, you know.
Did anybody ever call the cops on these guys, Nick? And, do you have any reports of any cops pulling them over and go, say, what are you mugs doing around here?
Well, there are reports where people have phoned the police or they phoned UFO researchers, like John Keel. When Keel was investigating the Mothman stuff at Point Pleasant, you know, the reason why he was able to chronicle it so well is because he would go out to the area for an extended period, you know, and stay in motels in town. And people occasionally said, you know, the guy's here right now. Get out here quickly. And, you know, but whenever that's happened, they've always vanished before the person's arrived, which has led me to believe that, you know, I don't believe these people are lying, but I do very often wonder if there's, you know, this whole issue of whether the experience occurred in like a 3D reality or if it was some sort of program, you know, instilled in their mind, you know, by whatever this intelligence is, you know, and that they can turn it off when they realize that there's going to be another person, you know, quickly coming on the scene. I mean, another reason why I think that could be the case is that very often people have said that when the Men in Black leave the house, you know, when they issue their threat and they leave, sometimes the person then afterwards, it's almost like their common sense factor comes back into play. They say, well, why on earth did I let those three weird guys in the house in the first place? So they race to the front door, open the front door, and they've gone. You know, you know, immediately, you know, they might have a driveway that's 100 feet long, and there's nowhere for them to go.
Still gone.
Yeah.
All right. We got a bail for a hard break. We'll be back with Nick Redfern, the Real Men in Black on Coast to Coast AM.